Usually on singing nights, we take the opportunity to examine a hymn and kind of study the words and go to the scriptures to see where it's been inspired from the hymn writer, to look at the scriptures and to, first of all, make sure what we're singing is according to scripture, but then also to have a better appreciation of it when we sing it. We're not going to do that this month. We'll pick that back up again next month. I've had many people tell me how much they enjoy that, so we will continue to do that on singing nights. However, this morning, we discussed the concept of destiny, fate, and free will. And we looked at the importance of knowing that God's Word teaches us that we have the choice whether or not we're going to obey Him. And given that fact, when we look at passages that some people seem to take in a way that suggests there is no free will, we realize that they're taking those passages out of context. And they're missing, in fact, the very reason why those texts are written to begin with. That God has established a plan for the people who would be His. He has established characteristics, qualifications, if you will, of the people that seek to worship Him. They must worship Him in spirit and in truth. They must conform to the image of His Son. But in the end, we know that there is going to be a judgment day, and there's nothing within us to be able to avoid that. We're going to stand in judgment. And there isn't any amount of free will that's going to be able to say, well, I don't want to go to hell. I'm going to go to heaven, even though I didn't do what was right. Christ is going to sit on the judgment seat and is going to judge whether or not we lived according to what the standard was. So we talked about the fact that, yes, when it comes to the Bible, there is, from a certain perspective, a concept of destiny or fate. That is the ultimate destiny and fate, which is judgment day. But when it comes to everything else, these are all choices that you and I make day to day, week to week, minute to minute. And it's important for us to understand and appreciate the fact that God has left our choices to us. But then as we ended this morning, we looked at the passage in Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 11, where at the end of that verse, Solomon says, after considering all these varying different individuals that he mentions there in verse 11, he says, in the end, time and chance happened to them all. So how does time and chance, or in particular the idea of coincidence and chance attached to the idea of time, how does that fit with our study this morning of destiny and fate and free will? Well, we consider the idea or the term for chance. It is something that is not planned or expected, accidental, an unfortunate event, a mishap, the absence of any cause of events that can be predicted, understood, or controlled. The term coincidence, just as we talked about with destiny and fate, how that the terms were nearly synonymous. Coincidence is a striking occurrence of two or more events at one time, apparently by mere chance, accident, luck, fate. There are people who have lost their lives because they put their faith in chance, in luck. There are people who have lost fortunes because of their belief that luck was with them. Chance and coincidence was on their side somehow. So when we consider these terms, chance and coincidence, I want you to, we're going to put this in the perspective of where we see in the Bible, where chance and coincidence has intervened seemingly to bring about an end result that was what God wanted. We have an example like in 1 Samuel chapter 6. In 1 Samuel chapter 6, we know that the Ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines for 7 months. And we see in verse 2, because of all the great despair that the Ark of the Covenant had brought upon the Philistines, keep in mind this is the same event as, or the same time frame where they had taken the Ark and the Ark had messed with their own god, Dagon, and it had caused plagues and so forth in the land. And we see in verse 2, the Philistines call for the priest and the diviner, saying, "What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send it to its place." And so they said, "If you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means return it to him with a trespass offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand is not removed from you." And they said, "What is the trespass offering that we shall return to him?" And they answered, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden rats, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines. For the same plague was on all of you and your lords. Therefore you shall make images of your tumors and images of your rats that ravage the land, and you shall give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from you, from your gods, and from your land. Why then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts when he did mighty things among them? Did they not let the people go that they might depart? Well, it's interesting. These priests of these pagan people who don't follow after Jehovah, but they do know their history. They know of the events that took place in Egypt. And they knew enough to say what they should do regarding this trespass offering. It certainly wasn't something that was part of the old law, making images of their tumors and the rats. But this is what the priests said would appease Jehovah. This was their guess, because they didn't have any background knowledge in it. Verse 7, "Therefore make a new cart, take 2 milk cows, which had never been yoked, take the ark of the Lord," verse 8, "set it on the cart, put the articles of gold which you are returning to him as a trespass offering in a chest by its side, and send it away and let it go." Verse 9, "And watch, if it goes up the road to its own territory, to Beth Shemesh, then he has done," talking about Jehovah, "he has done us this great evil. But if not, we shall know it is not his hand that struck us. It happened to us by chance." So the men did so. They took 2 milk cows and hitched them to the cart and shut up their calves at home. Verse 11, they set the Ark of the Covenant on the cart. Verse 12, and the cows headed straight down for the road to Beth Shemesh, and went along the highway, lowing as they went, and did not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. And the lords of the Philistines went after them to the border of Beth Shemesh. And as we see it, as we read further into 1 Samuel chapter 6 and chapter 7, how that they were relieved of their plagues and the maladies that God had placed upon the Philistines for having stolen the Ark of the Covenant. But it's interesting that these priests said, "All right, put it in a cart, just let them go. And if they head back to Israel, then we know it was Jehovah. But if they don't, or if they should turn to the side and stop or head somewhere else, it was just happenstance, just coincidence." You read this, at no point in the text does it say that God made the cows go to Beth Shemesh. And yet, that's the very point. That this was indeed God's power. But as far as they were concerned, and anybody observing the cows, they weren't seeing necessarily a miracle. A miracle is an observable suspension of natural law. But they understood enough to know that this will be, Jehovah will bring his ark home. So if they go to Beth Shemesh, Jehovah's bringing the ark home. But from a human perspective, to somebody, a third objective party who didn't know what was going on, some random cows walking down the road with a ark, golden ark in the back of a cart. But it was God doing it. In 2 Samuel chapter 1, 2 Samuel chapter 1, we have the event of Saul and Jonathan and the rest of the sons of Saul dying on the battlefield, as God had said would take place, and how that David would take over as king. He had been anointed long before Saul actually died. Remember, it was Saul and his decision to offer sacrifices a year into his reign that immediately caused God to say, "The kingdom's going to be taken from you." It wasn't until later with the Amalekites and the not killing of the livestock and the king that just reinforced it. But here in 2 Samuel chapter 1, it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, David stayed 2 days in Ziklag. On the third day, behold, it happened, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And so it was, when he came to David, he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to him, "Where have you come from?" He said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did the matter go? Please tell me." Keep in mind, David had had ample opportunity to kill Saul himself. Yet he would not raise a hand against God's anointed. He, in his mind, he knew God was going to take care of it. One way or the other, "I am not going to kill God's anointed. God will bring it about one way or another." So, he answered, "The people have fled from the battle. Many of the people are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also." Verse 5. So David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead?" Verse 6. The young man who told him said, "As I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa, there was Saul leaning on his spear. And indeed the chariots and the horsemen followed hard after him." And as we keep reading in the text, we find how that this young man comes near to Saul, and Saul calls out to him, "Please kill me." And the young man says, "You know, I'm seeing him. He's got what he believes to be a fatal wound or wounds. He's not going to survive. It's going to take forever for him to die. So I killed him. And I took his crown and his jewels, and I brought him to you." And David was, first of all, sad and mourned, first of all, because Jonathan, who he loved, was dead, but also because Saul certainly has died as well. But then he turned back to this young fella and he said, "Were you not afraid to raise your hand against God's anointed?" And David commanded that man to be killed because he killed Saul. And it's interesting to me that when you think about this account and you think about how it all happened, if indeed this young man was telling the truth, eventually Saul would have died on his own. He apparently was mortally wounded. It might have taken longer, and it probably would have been an excruciating death. And you could make the argument that this young fellow was really just doing him a favor to keep him from being in such agony. But David was furious. This man intervened. But I find it interesting that he himself said in verse 6, "I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa. I just happened to be there. I happened to see Saul. And this is what I did." Was it just coincidence? Or was there some purpose behind it? Some direction, some reason. You and I, as human beings, as objective third parties, let's say we don't know anything about the background of Jehovah. We see this cart going down the road. The Philistines are all happy because Jehovah has brought his ark home. Well, what do you mean? As an objective third party to this, you see, well, he just happened to be on the hill and he killed Saul. We may not know the backstory. We may not know why David was so angry about it. In Esther chapter 4 and in verse 13, the whole situation, the backstory with Esther, the decree from the king to kill all the Jews, he got tricked into decreeing. Mordecai sends a message to Esther, the queen. Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Mordecai doesn't mention Jehovah. He doesn't mention this idea of providence. Yet, he says, there will be deliverance from somewhere else. God's not going to let this happen to his people. Who knows whether you've come, you're in the position you're in now, for this reason. See, this is the thing about providence from human perspective. This is the thing about God's power working where we can't see and we can't observe. What we find is that in these cases, God's power is working. But where and how? And sometimes you might ask, why? There's a reason why we're going to these three examples and noting how they would look from a human, third-party, objective perspective. Turn with me now back to Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, and in verse 1, Solomon says, "For I considered all this in my heart, so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good, the clean, and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath as he who fears an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of the Son of Man are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love, their hatred, their envy have now perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. Go, eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, and let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which she has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going." You read that and go, man, that's depressing. But as we've already started to study on our Wednesday night adult class in Ecclesiastes, Solomon is writing these things from a human perspective and from a worldly perspective, as if when he writes it, he's saying, understand what priorities you should have. Understand what perspective you should have on your on this world and on your life. When he says here in verse 7, God has already accepted your works, what he means is that there is an understanding that there's only so much you can do in your life. He has appointed to man limits and boundaries. He has accepted your works in that you are human and mortal. This isn't a commentary to say, no matter how you want to do stuff and how you want to worship him or how you want to serve him, God will accept it. That is not what he's saying. It's in a context of man's physical life. God knows that you're mortal and that you're limited and that this is all you can do. He knows that because he made you that way. So when he goes on to verse 11, "I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift." You would think that the fastest person, fastest race car, will win. That should be a foregone logical conclusion. Solomon says, "No, I've observed it where the fastest haven't won. Nor the battle to the strong." Well, the smart or the strongest should always win the battles. "Nor bread to the wise." The wise don't always end up wealthy. nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. For man, verse 12, does not know his time. Like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, so the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. There are those who read this and think that God has just kind of left man to his own devices. God's not involved. God's not doing anything. That's not true. But he's also not rolling dice either. That's sometimes how this is taken. Well, God just kind of rolls dice and whatever happens, happens. What does Solomon mean when he says this? Remember what the context is. He is observing the mortal nature of man. He is looking at life from the perspective of a mortal. When he said the dead, they don't know anything, does that mean that their spirits don't exist in Hades, in the realm of the dead? No, they do. But Solomon's not looking at this from the lens of a overseeing understanding of the spiritual nature of man. He's looking at this purely from a physical perspective and saying, what point is it? You can't count on your speed. You can't count on your strength. You can't count on your wisdom or your understanding or your skill. None of those things will prevent you from dying because you're mortal. When Solomon writes what he writes in verse 11, time and chance happen to them all, he's writing that not from the perspective of God and not from the perspective of a Christian who views our world with a spiritual mind. He's writing this from the perspective of simply a mortal man. Just like with 1 Samuel chapter 6 and 2 Samuel chapter 1 and Esther chapter 4, from a purely physical, mortal perspective, with no ability to see the broader picture, just random coincidence, random chance. But Solomon, when he observes this, his very point is that man doesn't know. You don't know what's going to happen in 10 minutes, much less 20 minutes or an hour or a day or a year. Time and chance. That doesn't mean God's not in control. And that's the point, is that you have to have faith and trust. God knows what's going on. Because all throughout man's history with God, he has known everything that has happened with man. But you have to have faith that that's there. Because you're not going to see God's finger drawing from point A to point B to point C. You're not going to see God's expression of power that we call providence. The very nature of providence means you can't observe it. Yet you know it's there somewhere. What Solomon says, he says to remind you and me that you're mortal. You're not invincible. Sometimes it's the elderly who die. Sometimes it's the young people who die. That's not fair. That's life. Time and chance happen to them all. But does that mean God doesn't have a reason to allow these things to happen? That goes back to Romans chapter 8. God brings all things together for good to those who love God allows us to make our choices. He has not written our futures. From our perspective, especially from the way Solomon is using this filter to help us to really point out the fact that we need to have the proper perspective, events may take place that are beyond our control. We don't expect That's part of what makes life so enjoyable and yet at the same time scary. If you knew how it was all going to play out, then there really wouldn't be a lot of point in doing it. We make the choices we make. God's will is going to be done. Regardless of what we do, we're not going to mess up God's plan. But He uses our choices to bring about what He wants. He always has. He always will. Mordecai brought that out. Esther, if you don't do it, it'll still happen. Deliverance will still come. That's the faith of Mordecai. On the eve, for all intents and purposes, of the destruction of the Jews, even though he doesn't actually say, Jehovah, God will deliver us. But Esther, maybe this is why. All these events happened to bring you to this point. In the end, how we conduct ourselves and obey God's word will decide what our end will be in judgment. There's a reason why Solomon concludes this book of Ecclesiastes with the concept, with the words, fear God and keep His commandments. This is man's all. Because without God, without fearing Him and keeping His commandments, what does man have? Vanity, vanity. All is vanity. Trust that God knows what's happening. Trust that God knows what's going on. He does. But He's going to let you make your choices. And just as Trice brought out this past Wednesday night, there's opportunities to test us, to make us stronger, that God allows to come our way. He's not stacking the deck against us. He's trying to help us. The question is, are we going to let Him? Are we going to hear the call that rings forward from the gospel to those who are not Christians to become Christians after sins washed away? To those of us who are Christians to put our faith in the power and providence of God and to recognize that we are mortal? Do things happen seemingly by chance and coincidence? Yeah, seemingly. But God is always in control. He leaves it up to you, though, how you're going to respond to these events that happen. We've said it before, and I think it's a great thought, great quote. Life is 10% what happens to you, 90% of how you deal with it. We offer the invitation. If you're subject, please come forward as we stand and sing.